possible by listeners like you who donate at WJFFradio.org.
Live from the WJFF studios in Liberty, New York, this is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. On today's show, debate reaction. We're joined by WAMC News Director Ian Pickus to break down last night's debate between former President Donald Trump and Vice President Kamala Harris. It marked the first time the two went head-to-head in this election cycle. What was the overall impression, and how might it change the race, if at all? Plus, science stories with Joe Johnson, including news from the edge of space and transparent mice. It has something to do with Doritos. Plus, culture reporter Valerie Manzi speaks to the three solo artists in the upcoming Farm Arts show this weekend, and an update from Sullivan 180's Denise Frangipane. All coming up, but first, the news from NPR.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. A memorial ceremony is underway in New York City, honoring the victims of the 9/11 terror attacks. The observance began this morning with a moment of silence and music.
Right, quick, march!
Mourners are reading the names of the people who were killed. This is the 23rd anniversary of the attacks. Al-Qaeda terrorists hijacked two passenger planes and flew them into the two towers of the World Trade Center in New York. Both buildings collapsed. Terrorists commandeered two more planes and flew one into the Pentagon. Passengers aboard a fourth plane assaulted their hijackers, who then crashed the plane into the ground in Shanksville, Pennsylvania. It's believed those hijackers intended to try to attack the U.S. Capitol. Former President Donald Trump and Vice President Kamala Harris sparred in their debate last night over several issues that included immigration, a key topic in the campaign. NPR's Sergio Martinez-Beltran reports.
During the 90 minutes the presidential debate lasted, Trump used a racist narrative about migrants being criminals. But studies show migrants commit fewer crimes than U.S.-born people. He claimed Haitian migrants in Ohio are eating pets, but that's false. There's no evidence of what he's accusing them of doing. As for Harris, she blamed Trump for killing a bipartisan border deal, something he takes credit for, and she dodged a question about why the Biden administration waited so long to implement policies to lower the number of unauthorized crossings at the U.S. southern border. Harris did not provide any details about her plan to reform the immigration system. Sergio Martinez-Beltran, NPR News, Austin.
Hurricane Francine is fewer than 200 miles southwest of the Louisiana coast. The storm could be a Category 2 hurricane when it makes landfall. That's expected later today. The National Hurricane Center is warning of life-threatening storm surge that could hit as much as 10 feet. Stocks opened lower this morning as the Labor Department reported the lowest annual inflation rate in 3.5 years. NPR's Scott Horsley reports the Dow Jones Industrial Average tumbled 530 points in early trading.
Consumer prices in August were up 2.5% from a year ago. That's the smallest annual increase since early 2021, and clears the way for the Federal Reserve to start cutting interest rates when policymakers meet next week. Housing costs continue to climb, but gasoline prices have fallen sharply in the last year, and grocery prices rose less than 1%. The overall cost of living continues to climb faster than the Federal Reserve would like, but inflation has cooled significantly after hitting a four-decade high 2 years ago. The central bank is now worried about keeping interest rates too high, which could unnecessarily slow the economy and trigger a jump in unemployment. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
On Wall Street, the Dow is now down 550 points. It's NPR. Secretary of State Antony Blinken is in Ukraine with Britain's Foreign Secretary David Lammy. Ukraine is pressing the Allies to help lift restrictions on the use of long-range missiles. These have been provided by the Allies for defense purposes. Ukraine wants to use the weapons to strike military targets deep inside Russia. President Biden says he is outraged by the Israeli military's killing last week of an American citizen visiting the Israeli-occupied West Bank. Israel says its troops unintentionally killed her. NPR's Daniel Estrin reports from Tel Aviv.
Aisha Noor Eget was a recent graduate of the University of Washington in Seattle. She was killed while attending a West Bank protest against Israel's expansion of settlements on land Palestinians claim. Israel's military expressed regret and said soldiers aimed their fire not at her, but at someone who had instigated clashes and rock throwing. President Biden said she traveled to the West Bank to peacefully protest and that the shooting was, quote, totally unacceptable. He said Israel must do more to ensure a similar incident never happens again. This is the second Israeli military killing of a U.S. citizen in the West Bank since an Al Jazeera journalist was killed in 2022. Daniel Estrin, NPR News, Tel Aviv.
Authorities in Serbia say that drought conditions over the summer have lowered water levels significantly in the Danube River. Now, the wreckage of four ships owned by the Nazis during World War II are emerging. The Nazis scuttled the ships as Soviet troops advanced. Serbian officials say some of the Nazi ships still have explosives aboard. I'm Korva Coleman, NPR News, from Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Charles Schwab, offering investors choices like full-service wealth management, advice, investing, and trading on Thinkorswim. Learn more at schwab.com. And the listeners who support this NPR station.
Welcome back to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Last night's highly anticipated debate between Vice President Kamala Harris and former President Donald Trump marked the first time the two went head-to-head in this election cycle. The majority of the focus coming into Tuesday was about how Harris would handle her first-ever presidential debate with someone who's had experience with this. I've been on the stage many times. Could she answer questions about her position shifts, parry attacks from Trump? Someone who tries to be the alpha on these stages. Could she answer the attack that she's light on policy, and could she appear presidential? Let's get some reaction from the news director at WAMC, Ian Pickus. He joins us on the phone right now. Ian, good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for being here. What was your overall impression of last night's debate?
The thing I've been wondering so far in the hours since, maybe it's been about 12 hours since they wrapped up, is, was anybody swayed by last night's performance? Because we know that it's such a narrow sliver of the electorate that remains available and undecided at this point. And the other thing this morning is that so much has a different feeling from the first debate when President Biden and Trump faced off back in June. I've been talking to some Democrats who work in Congress. And then this morning, Congressman Paul Tonko of the 20th District in New York had a press availability to talk about the debate. And the mood is very much different from where things were in June. So those are the two big issues in my mind. Was anybody's mind changed by seeing Trump being Trump and Harris, by all accounts, performing pretty well last night?
I've been thinking the same. I mean, arguably, she handled Trump better than anyone has at a debate, whether it was Hillary Clinton in 2016 or Joe Biden in 2020. And most pundits are saying that, you know, Harris, quote unquote, won. But you're right. Are the undecided voters, that sliver of people who are going to decide this, swayed at all? People are still pessimistic rather than optimistic about the economy. And, you know, they're still concerned about immigration, the war in the Middle East. Do these folks change their minds after seeing this?
You know, I think if you separate the question from the personalities involved, there really are some stark policy differences that were on display in the debate. I thought ABC's moderators did a very nice job pinning former President Trump down about the question about the war in Ukraine and whether he actually wants to see Ukraine defeat Russia. And he would not answer that question. So that right there is a huge policy difference between the two. And traditionally, you know, we would expect that American foreign policy would be on the side of Ukraine in this particular instance. There were also huge differences over the issue of abortion, of access to reproductive health care that were on display. And then with respect to the economy, there are two very different tax programs available based on these candidates for voters to make a decision between. So if you were going beyond kind of the surface level insults and the facial expressions and that part of the performance, There's a clear choice here in November.
Yeah, and on those policy positions, Trump was on the defensive and evasive, even on some issues that should benefit him. If our people are, pessimistic rather than optimistic about the economy, he could have gone in a little bit more, but didn't really land much of anything that stuck. And he really kind of just kept repeating lies and about the past.
I thought Vice President Harris, too, she was very disciplined in staying on the message that she wanted to get across, just in a way that at this point, we've been watching him on the presidential debate stages for basically a decade at this point. And former President Trump doesn't really do that. He is a freewheeling speaker. He wants to hammer home some different insults. But the things that are getting a lot of attention today, like this debunked story about immigrants eating cats and dogs, that did not help President Trump stay on his message, which has centered on the fact that Vice President Harris and President Biden have had 4 years, and for many people, inflation has not come down far enough, and wages have lagged, and so on. So I think, if you were watching that, waiting for him to capitalize on an apparent weakness on the Democratic side, that didn't always happen, and Harris was much more disciplined with even when she got a question that she maybe didn't want to answer, pivoting to one that she did want to answer, which is why sometimes it can be so hard to interview elected officials.
Yeah, I mean, it really was kind of debate 101 here. You see Harris attacking, getting some of the policy in, and then going back on putting some bait out. And he took the bait almost every time. I wanted to ask you about what you think it means in terms of like the down the ballot races, especially here in New York, where we have very contested district races, including New York 19, with Molinaro and Riley. Do you think that this debate will filter down into these state level races, or will it, federal races that can impact the balance of power in Congress?
The short answer is absolutely, because the pressure from the down ballot candidates really is what led to President Biden being forced out of his reelection bid. If the very close marginal House races, and there are not that many, if we're talking about 435 House seats and let's say 40 or 50 are actually in play, you need to win every one of those. And if the Republicans want to keep control, they've got to keep the seats that they flipped the last time. And the Democrats have their eyes on those same seats to turn them back this time around. And if those candidates had felt that President Biden was winning, President Biden would probably still be on the ticket for November. So we saw it after Kamala Harris was designated as the nominee. We saw it at the convention. And I think from seeing the reaction from her supporters in the spin room and in the hours since last night's debate, Democrats are clearly feeling a lot better about this election than they were in June. Now, that being said, President Trump has his strong supporters, and for them, that was vintage Trump last night also. They're very difficult to shake. He's got a lock on, a third of the country easily, and his supporters and surrogates like Northern New York Congresswoman Elise Stefanik were quick to claim victory themselves.
Last night, former President Trump again offered the mixed messages on abortion. It didn't really explain really very well what he believed. Also went into this untrue theory about having killing a baby after birth, really, is what he said, which is not true, obviously. But in the Molinaro race, especially with Riley, the Democratic National Committee is really spending a lot of ads. I don't know about you, but down here, I can't escape those ads on air, really hammering him over his votes on abortion.
Yeah, you think that's some of them during the debate last night, that's for sure.
So do you think that's going to push people, or change the direction of that race?
You know what? I think that remains a very key issue in local races. And I go back to the special election 2 years ago between, at the time, two county executives, Molinaro and Pat Ryan, and they were running for a seat that then got redrawn shortly thereafter. But that was the main issue in that race, abortion. It was right after the Dobbs decision, and I don't think that has been a winning issue for Republicans in the time since. And it puts President Trump in kind of an unusual situation where he would love to take credit, as he did last night, for Roe v. Wade being overturned. But throwing it back to the states has led to a mishmash of policies, as Vice President Harris mentioned in the debate, from one state to another, some with extreme restrictions in place and some like New York where they're considering bolstering protections. And it's quite clear that candidates, Democratic candidates like Josh Riley, as you mentioned, think that abortion remains a winning issue for the Democratic Party. It has been in the last two cycles, as far as we can tell.
Wanted to ask you about something else besides the debate while I have you. Former Governor Andrew Cuomo was on Capitol Hill yesterday at a COVID hearing, clashing with New York Representative Lisa Stefanik. What can you tell us about that?
Well, it was very interesting to hear that voice again talking about COVID-19. I think all of us have a sense memory associated with the daily Cuomo briefings back in the first half of 2020 and during the pandemic. And, you know, I wasn't surprised by much of what I saw in the testimony. It was kind of unusual to see Stefanik and Cuomo talking face to face. That really hasn't happened in public that I can remember. And also people on that subcommittee like Marjorie Taylor Greene. It's, you know, pretty obvious that Cuomo was dragged before that committee to drill down on the question of that nursing home policy from very early in the pandemic, March of 2020. And also, former Governor Cuomo is not going to move off the position that has been his line since that was first looked at as being potentially contributing toward the number of infections and deaths in nursing homes, that there was a lack of federal guidance, that the science was not being followed by the Trump administration, and it left a void, and New York was basically doing what it knew it could do at a time when there was very little information to go off. He has rejected the claims that his office kind of doctored a further report exonerating the earlier March 2020 memo, and that remains the key sticking point in all of this. Whether we learned anything new in the show yesterday, I'm not sure, but the dividing lines are as strong as ever with people who have looked back and the role of this committee looking back at what a lot of Democratic governors chose to do back at the beginning of the pandemic. It was a lot of crosstalk and yelling, so yeah. It set us up nicely for the debate last night.
Yeah, good primer for the debate. Back to the debate and the general. One last question. Do you think childless cat ladies will now change the course of who's president?
Well, I don't know about Taylor Swift's impact on the electorate, but I would have to say it's not zero. And after the debate, she was very quick to endorse Vice President Harris and sign off as a childless cat lady. So there are some of them out there, I understand. That was J.D. Vance's contribution to this election. If you can convince any percentage of person who might not have been interested in voting or who might have been interested in voting but is now rethinking the way they're voting, that's what this race is likely to come down to in six or seven states. We're talking about a percentage of a percentage, and that I'm sure will have some effect.
Look what they made her do. WAMC's news director, Ian Pickus, thank you so much for joining us, and we'll talk to you again soon, I'm sure, in the next, 55 days.
That's right. The countdown's on. Tim, thank you for having me. As always, it was a pleasure.
All right. And today, of course, the nation is marking the 9/11 anniversary of the terror attacks on September 11th, 2001. In addition to the 3,000 people killed that day in New York City, outside Washington, D.C., and in Shanksville, Pennsylvania. First responders have been steadily dying of 9/11-related illnesses in the two decades since. Now, Region 2 Deputy Administrator for the Federal Emergency Management Agency, Andrew DeMora, responded to the attacks while working as a commanding officer of the Operations Division of the New York City Police Department. He says it's always a somber anniversary.
I've lost four friends in the last year from 9/11-related illness. You know, I think of them, especially my good friend, I'll mention his name, Joe Esposito is the chief of department for the NYPD, and he was the hero of 9/11. He was on top of the pile every day and making sure that families were getting the proper due, especially relocating and recovering their relatives, police officers especially. But, you know, that day itself, you know, it's my daughter's first day of kindergarten. You know, now she's 26, going to be 27.
You're listening to Radio Chatskill. We'll take a break. Be right back.
Radio Catskill supporters include the Sterling Business and Technology Park, located at Exit 17 on Interstate 84 in Northeast Pennsylvania, offering opportunities to locate or expand businesses on property zoned for manufacturing and other uses. More information at sterlingbusinesspark.com. And listeners like you who donate at wjffradio.org.
Hey everybody, it's Jeff Loeffler of The Deep End. Join me each and every Friday night from 10 to midnight as I dig deep into the catalogs of bands you may know, some you may not know. You'll hear from The Grateful Dead, The Allman Brothers, Chris Robinson Brotherhood, and so much more. The Deep End, Friday night, 10 to midnight on Radio Catskill.
Welcome back to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Sullivan 180 is the organization in Sullivan County that is trying to turn around the policies and health of Sullivan County one degree at a time. And joining us now is executive director or CEO, your grand poobah. It's Denise Frangipani.
Chief cook and bottle washer, that's my me mom too. Would say.
How are you this morning?
I am great. How are you, Tim?
Good. Thanks for coming in and, sure. and giving us the latest update on Sullivan 180.
Absolutely.
Are we talking about the winner of the fire department challenge yet?
We can talk about whatever you like. I do want to acknowledge the healthiest fire
yes.
department challenge.
Okay, good. And I wasn't sure if I was supposed to say or not.
That's okay. Well, it's public now.
Okay,
everyone
good.
Knows. And then talk a little bit about what's coming up.
Yeah, but, absolutely. So who won? Who won?
So the grand winners in this year's health, well, let's say, not to be cliche, but everyone who participated is a winner.
Is a winner.
Because we're already, you know, just like our mission is one degree at a time, one person at a time, we can all make small changes one degree at a time. But the big prize, the big grant winning prize went to the Monticello Fire Department.
All right. Yay.
Yeah.
Go yep. Monticello. Congratulations.
Yeah, it was exciting. And second prize, yes, ding, ding. And second prize went to Roscoe Rockland Fire Department.
And this was, of course, a challenge focusing on the health and well-being of the county's firefighters.
Yes.
They competed,
yep.
friendly, in these healthy challenges. And the winner receives a nice prize there.
So the winning, the winner receives the top prize. And then the second place winner, there's two different grants. The first prize is $15,000 and second prize is $10,000. The second prize, interesting, I just want to point out, was made possible with support from the 2024 WSUL Heartathon. And the reason I bring that up is because that's, you know, direct donation to the Heartathon that goes directly back into the community for prevention. And then that's really important. That's how we are all working on this together. Mm-hmm. So yes, it is a competition because keep it fun, make it competitive, but it's all based on a point system, based on activities. And those are health related activities, which are really moving the culture of the departments toward healthier lifestyles through food, physical activity, and mental health, and all the things that contribute to being a healthier person.
And it's really been having a good impact. I mean, each year you've seen increases of participation.
Yeah,
which
this
means
year we had 19 fire departments participate. And aside from the grand prizes, this year we also introduced a tiered system. So it gave opportunity for departments who were actively participating to continue to kind of climb a ladder of points to receive grants. So everyone walked away with something this year. Turtle Awards, which were sponsored by local businesses to recognize specific efforts within a department. And all that funding gets reinvested in their department, and they might reinvest it in other activities to continue their health journey, or they might use it toward equipment, you know, obviously necessary equipment that is expensive, and it helps to have a little bit of extra funding to support that work.
What else is coming up with us for the fall for Sullivan 180?
So I really want to talk about our evening of appreciation. Yeah. You'll probably hear about this more. I brought you an invitation.
Oh, how lovely.
Yes, it's a lovely printed one.
Well, thank you.
But I want to say that everyone is welcome. It is an open invitation to join us as we celebrate all of the volunteers volunteers and all the efforts throughout Sullivan County on every level to move us toward health. And, you know, we're not there yet. We haven't completed this journey. It's just like when you're traveling with your family and they're like, are we there yet? Are we there yet? Same, right? We're enjoying what's happening along the way of a journey, but also on this journey, we are seeing results. We're seeing impact. We're seeing changes coming in policy. We're seeing changes coming in just the general way that we're experiencing the program and the impact in our schools, as we said, the fire department, our communities, our public spaces. It really is a movement throughout the county, and that's what this evening is about. It's about saying, look what we've accomplished so far as a community, and here's how you can get involved. If you've never heard about us, this is a great time to show up. It's on Thursday, September 26th at 5:30 at Bethel Woods. It'll be a beautiful evening, I'm sure. Show up and learn about our work, how you can get involved, the things have been done, and celebrate together.
And, so, you know, we have been seeing some results in the county, and we've talked to you and other folks who are stakeholders in this effort to churn around all of the different aspects of public health. And yes, we've seen some improvement, but there's a reason why the logo for Sullivan 180 is a turtle.
Right.
It does take a minute.
It takes a little bit more than a minute, right? And I think in terms of results, what we are also seeing is more resources being invested in our community to help with prevention. That is our key. I mean, if we can focus on prevention, we can eliminate some of the issues that will come down the line. So our work really is hyper-focused on prevention. We are seeing resources through funding and through policy that are coming into Sullivan County, and the collaboration among the county overall between the leadership from the county health department, you know, the work that John Little is doing through the task forces and the different partnerships that are coming through the county, and the work that's happening on a grassroots movement through all of the different projects throughout the county. It's kind of just, it's all coming together. Mm-hmm. And I think it's exciting to see that and to see it's on people's mind. Prevention is right on our windshield, so to speak. So.
I think everyone is looking to change that. I mean, I think we've seen that here, at least in Sullivan County specifically, being mired in this one spot for so long, and to see some initiative happening, see some developments going on, it really does feel as if it is encouraging.
It is encouraging. And to know that there is more access to opportunities to make healthy choices, you know, that's important too.
And what you're doing with kids too at the school level, the Healthier Generation initiative, the Edible Garden, you know, lots starting there and getting those kids to see that there is a choice.
So prevention and youth, that's our focus. So I think if you're listening right now and you have a child in school or a school-aged child, think about what's happening at your school. Our Sullivan County schools are often, you know, We hear a lot of criticism about public schools, but I will say that our schools are working really hard. There's a lot of demands on our schools with minimal resources available. So we wanted to make this call to action easier for schools by providing them with grants and support to help them create wellness programs and initiatives for their students, for their staff, and for their school community. So there's a lot that's happening. And if you need information about something that might impact you personally or in your community or your school, you can call us. You can come to our website, sullivan180.org. Call us at 295-2680. Hit us up on Facebook. I say that
all
right?
All places. I think so.
Or join us on September 26th at 5:30 at Bethel Woods.
Sullivan 180 is the nonprofit organization dedicated to building a healthy community through people, places, and policy. Denise Frangipani is chief bottle washer, and she joins us this morning.
Going to go wash some bottles now.
I'll let you go.
Thanks. Have a great day. Take care, Denise. Bye-bye.
All right. We'll take a break. And when we come back, some science stories from Joe Johnson.
Last year, over 100,000 people died from drug overdoses driven by fentanyl. And the fastest growing group is under 19. Fentanyl is the number one cause of overdose in Sullivan County. Whether you're a parent or an educator, you can have the right conversation now to potentially save a kid's life. Protect kids from the dangers of fentanyl. More information and resources at naturalhigh.org. Paid for by Catholic Charities of Orange, Sullivan, and Ulster.
Welcome back to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Joe Johnson is a former Port Jervis science teacher and Radio Catskill volunteer. He joins us every week, well, almost every week. He took a little break in August, but he's back with some science stories, including transparent mice, a few science story corrections, and new discoveries at the edge of the solar system in the Kuiper Belt.
This comes from a September 4th press release by the Subaru Telescope in Hawaii. The main parts of the solar system, the Sun, Mercury, Venus, Earth, Mars, Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune. And a lot of people even know about the asteroid belt that exists between Mars and Jupiter. But beyond the orbit of Neptune lies the Kuiper Belt from about 30 to 50 astronomical units. An astronomical unit is the distance from the Earth to the Sun, the average distance. They've turned it into a unit of measurement, and they kind of compare everything else in the solar system to it. Okay, so the Kuiper Belt is this donut-shaped ring that's around the solar system. It was first proposed by a Dutch astronomer, Gerard Kuiper, back in 1951. He thought that there's going to be something farther out there beyond Neptune and well, Pluto at that time was still considered a planet. And there are a lot of objects out there. There are icy, rocky bodies. This is where some comet nuclei, short-period comet nuclei, come from. The best-known Kuiper Belt object is Pluto, which is about 39 times farther away from the Sun than we are, about 39 astronomical units. But the Subaru Telescope has found 239 new bodies in the near Kuiper Belt and 11 bodies much farther out where it was predicted that there would be nothing. Okay. Now, Pluto, if we go back to that, that was visited by the New Horizons spacecraft in 2015. And, you know, it gave us amazing photos of the surface of Pluto and great photos of Charon, which is one of the, which is the moon of Pluto. But it kept going past Pluto and it visited another object called Arrokoth. Arrokoth is, for all the world, it looks like a snowman in space. It's two big icy bodies that are stuck together. If you haven't seen a picture of it, look it up online. It's really, really cool. It's about 22-mile long snowman, though. So the Subaru Telescope was put into use to try and find objects that New Horizons could visit, all right, in the you know, farther out in the Kuiper Belt. Because it's not coming back to Earth and it's on a trajectory. We can tweak that trajectory a little bit. So, but they tried to look ahead of it and they found 239 new objects. Now, unfortunately, none of them were within the fuel of the New Horizons spacecraft. But the exciting part of this is way beyond where they thought the Kuiper Belt ended. They have found 11 new objects out there between 70 and 90 astronomical units away from the Sun. These are things that we had no idea were there. They are unknown to science. They were not even theorized to be there.
So unknown to science, not expected to be there. What kind of implications does this discovery have on our understanding of the structure of the solar system and the history of the solar system?
Well, it's going to have we're going to have to rewrite some models of the early solar system because this planetary nebula, this solar nebula that the sun and the planets and everything formed from was apparently much larger than we previously thought it was. And so this is going to have to cause some people to rethink their models of how this all happened.
Do we know if they're like remnants of planets or?
They're probably leftovers from the solar system, from the formation of the solar system. When the sun ignited, it kind of swept a lot of stuff out of the solar system. It was a big explosion. And it swept a lot of stuff farther out. Some of it formed what's called the Oort cloud, which is even larger. That's a big cloud around the solar system. This is where long period comets come from. And also formed the Kuiper Belt, which is where the shorter period comets form from. So these are icy, rocky bodies, probably very pristine, left over from the formation of the solar system. So if we can get out there and sample them, we can certainly tell a little bit more about what the early solar system was like.
As we look for life out there, yes, in the solar system, does this increase the possibilities that that could exist?
I don't know that there's going to be life out there because it's awful dark and awful cold. If you could stand on one of these Kuiper Belt objects out there, say 70 or 80 astronomical units away from the sun and look back at the sun, it would just look like a very bright star in the blackness of space. So there's not a lot of energy out there. It is very dark and very cold out there. Once again, though, it's the chemistry. That's what is really exciting scientists.
You have some updates for us from some other science stories we've talked about.
I do. Last June, we talked about the Boeing Starliner. And if you remember, the Boeing Starliner was a spacecraft that was supposed to basically act as a taxi between Earth and the International Space Station. It was Boeing's entry into the competition with SpaceX and a couple of other companies. They have had a lot of delays and technical problems, a lot of valve issues. Their first flight in 2019 was 2 years behind their first launch planning. They were not able to dock that first time. The second time, unmanned. They were able to dock and get home, but there were still these thruster problems. This third mission, the current mission, launched June 5th and was supposed to come back June 14th. However, if you've been following this online or in the news, you know that it did not. They had a lot of problems docking, and they were unsure what would happen when they undocked it. So the decision, they went back and forth quite a bit, and the decision was finally made to bring it home unmanned. They had to actually reprogram it because the software would not allow it to be done that way.
NASA thought the trip with a crew would be too risky.
Right. They thought it would be too risky to risk the two astronauts, Sonny Williams and Butch Wilmore. And so they brought it back. It did land without a hitch last Friday morning in the New Mexico desert. And the two astronauts will be coming home in February on a SpaceX Crew Dragon spaceship. And so they're actually coming home on their competitor's ride.
Still some more issues that Boeing has to deal with in their space business and with Starliner.
Absolutely. It also shows us that, it's become almost commonplace to go to space. But there's still a lot of problems. There's still a lot of issues involved. For instance, their spacesuits were not compatible with the SpaceX capsule. And so the crew that's going up in February was going to originally have four astronauts on board. Well, now they can only have two, and they're sending up an additional couple of spacesuits so they can wear them on the way back.
And what else do you have for us in terms of updates?
Well, I wanted to update the solar sail. We talked about this last May. This was launched in April, and it's basically a solar sail. It's a big composite system that inflates in orbit, and it's about 10 meters by 10 meters Mylar-covered plastic. And so they're trying to test the idea whether they can use this to deorbit stuff, whether they can use this to change the orbit of a spacecraft without having to use rocket fuel, because rocket fuel is awful energy rich. It takes a lot to get it up there.
This is being powered by the sun.
Yes. It's essentially a sail, and the pressure of the light actually hitting it is what pushes it.
So it's up in orbit now?
It is. It was sent up on what's called a CubeSat. The satellite was literally the size of a large microwave oven, and this thing was folded up inside. It had arms, booms that shot out, almost like a tape measure will, and they deployed it. It deployed perfectly, and so they're testing it now. They say it's tumbling in orbit, which they say is normal, but I kind of don't get that part of it. The thing I want to make people aware of, though, is that this is going to be visible from Earth.
Yeah, I was going to ask if you could see it.
Sure. It's orbiting about 600 miles up, which is definitely higher than normal satellites, which are around 200 to 300 miles up. But this thing is so large. It's, 10 meters by 10 meters, and it's shiny aluminum. If you have the NASA app on your phone, or you can download it and go to the ACS-3 mission, it will actually tell you when it's coming over.
And you can share your experience, hashtag spot the sail. And a science correction, I understand.
Yes. Early in August, we spoke about the Herculaneum papyri, which are papyrus scrolls that were found in the town of Herculaneum that was buried by Vesuvius during the eruption in 79 AD. And I made a mistake, and it really bothered me. Herculaneum was discovered in 1709, and I said that the papyri were discovered in 1652, which doesn't work. I meant 1752. And as soon as I heard it on the playback, I was like, oh, I was mad at myself.
Glad that you corrected yourself.
And I'm sure there's other people that heard it too.
All right, our last story, and we save the best for last. Explain to me how transparent mice were potentially made or have been made
Yes.
by dye found in Doritos.
Yes, and Mountain Dew as well. There's a lot of it in Mountain Dew. So scientists have a lot of ways to see inside an organism. We can X-ray, we can do ultrasound, MRI, endoscopy. There's a lot of ways, but they're invasive. They require a lot of energy. So scientists at Stanford University have used a new method using that common food dye, which is FD&C number 5. And like you said, it's in Doritos, it's in Mountain Dew, it's in a lot of candy. It's a very bright yellow dye. It's what gives Mountain Dew that, like, you know, almost glowing greenish yellow color. So it's important to think about, like, why we can't see it through an organism normally. If you look at a mice, you can't see through its skin, and that's because materials, primarily the cell membranes, absorb and scatter light because they have a different index of refraction. Index of refraction is how light bends as it goes through something. The index is actually a measurement of it. Okay, air is around 1.0, water is about 1.3. And lipids, which are what we're talking about here, lipids are like fatty and waxy molecules, they have an index of refraction of about 1.7. And the cell membranes are made of primarily lipids with some proteins. So light can't penetrate and be reflected from the internal structures because of this mismatch between the indices of refraction. So it's the cells actually act almost like little lenses, just bending the light and absorbing the light in weird ways. So scientists thought about, what if we could make the interior of the cell index of refraction match the lipids? And they did this by just soaking these mice. They shaved the mice to get all the hair off, and then they literally soaked them in this FD&C number 5, and it turned their skin transparent. So transparent that they could actually see the muscle fibers. They can see blood flowing through capillaries. They can see peristalsis, which is the motion of your intestines pushing food through, that's squeezing motion back and forth. And I chose this story this week just because it is so weird.
It is weird. The science behind it is to find better methods to see tissues and organs within the body.
Sure.
But just having the association with what many people have as a favorite snack is a little concerning, I would say.
So if you're sitting out there eating Doritos and drinking Mountain Dew.
Will I become invisible?
That's an interesting thought. They've been able to actually see through the skulls of these mice too, because the skulls are transparent. They've been able to see the brain and blood flow in the brain. They've been able to, using a fluorescent dye that sparkles when a neuron fires, they've been able to see brain activity going on. And could this happen in humans? Could we do this in humans? And the answer is, well, probably not, because our skin is a lot thicker than mouse skin. But I will say that the mice were not harmed by this. They washed the dye off. The dye that actually got into the cells was metabolized, and, you know, it's a food dye. It's fairly safe. And, so the mice lived happily ever after.
Oh, darn. I thought if I would go slather myself in nacho cheese Doritos, I'd have like a cloak of invisibility, like Harry Potter or something, but you're saying no. Okay.
Well, you could try.
Joe Johnson with some science stories this week. Always fascinating. Thank you.
Thank you.
You're listening to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Farm Arts Collective is presenting a weekend of innovative original solo performances, the Alone Together Solo Play Festival of solo works by women artists who are exploring theatrical forms and the human condition. Culture reporter Valerie Manzi spoke to the artists Ellie J., Morgan McKenzie Kaufman, and Tanis Kowalczyk.
Good morning, ladies, and welcome to Radio Chatskill.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Tanis, Ellie, and Morgan are all going to be speaking about an upcoming event at Farm Arts Collective this weekend entitled Alone Together Solo Play Festival. And the community will be able to see three individual performances by writer, actor, creators, all of whom are women, and they will all be solo shows. One is on Friday night, the 13th at 7:30, and that's Fool by Clown Daddy, and Ellie will be talking to us about that. Saturday night, the 14th at 7:30, we'll have Morgan McKenzie Kaufman, Dora's Gently Used Dream Store. And on Sunday, the 15th at 2 p.m., we will have Tanis Kowalczuk and Decompositions. So, Tanis, let's start with you and your inspiration for this particular festival.
Sure. Well, having made a theater performance alone and having performed it now about a year or two, I've been doing Decompositions. I really wanted to bring together other artists, other female artists who are making solo performances and working individually. And I wanted us to come together to share our work, because sometimes it can feel lonely when you're making a solo performance. You know, you only get a chance to, like, you know, you rehearse. We were talking about this in the car, Ellie and I. You know, you're rehearsing by yourself for a long time. You're alone for a long time. And then finally you get to have that experience with the audience. So it just was, is it going to be a really interesting, event to have all of us come together for that weekend and support each other and see each other's work and be alone together. And, I really want to also promote the work of women artists, in the theater, people who are creating work, writing their work, performing their work. I think that, we still need to fight for that, for our place in the world of theater. Women have to fight for their place in lots of different aspects of life. And so I just really want to uplift and promote and, shine a spotlight on women artists.
Okay. So let's begin with Ellie J, and, you will be doing Fool by Clown Daddy. So that sounds very interesting.
Interesting is a good start, for sure. Yes. Yes, I'm also known as Clown Daddy in these parts. That is my theater name, I suppose we could go with, my stage persona. So Fool, the full title is Fool, The Wanderings of the Last Clown on Earth.
Wow.
And it was inspired loosely by the isolation that we felt during the COVID times. The times of the plague. And I don't know how you feel about this, Tanis and Morgan, but I, as a primarily solo performer, I am very much of that vaudevillian style, Buster Keaton, Charlie Chaplin clown. I have to bully myself to get myself to work. And so there was a certain point where almost 2 years ago, where I was like, I have to create something. And when something is scary, that's usually what you need to go towards. And I was like, I'm so terrified of making my own one-woman show. So I was like, let's start there. So I did this piece about a clown who is alone in a bunker. And there are always aspects of clowning in my performances where it's like, oh, there's a gag and there's a bit and that's funny. And there's a dance break with Pierre, who's my coat rack on wheels. It's a really fun moment. You see that a lot in my performances. And that's fun and all. But I also wanted to engage with what a clown, which is usually ha ha he he, what a clown experiences when she is sad and alone and hungry and scared and doesn't want to go outside. And then, of course, at some point during the show Fool, something happens and she does go outside. And there's that shift change. And I performed the show last year in May at the Rivoli Theater in Fallsburg. And it was just so, when you put art out there, there's a certain point where it is no longer yours, it's the audience's. And that's the same with musicians and painters, photographers. And there were 4-year-olds in the audience, and there were 89-year-olds in the audience, and everyone had a different take of what the show was about, what they enjoyed about the show, what they were able to take away from it. And some people thought it was about the Holocaust. Some people got the feeling of it being about COVID. Others, it was their own understanding of what it meant to be locked alone in a room. And, of course, it was so much fun to have the kids in the audience who was like, I like the part about the flower. And I was like, great, I'm so glad. And then the person next to them is 55 years old. They're like, I also like the part about the flower. And there is a part in the end of the show where there is a very sincere and very important connection with the audience. And I'm very excited to experience that again, especially because in this world, we need laughter and we need connection with technology and AI and things going where as quickly as it's going. It's very important to be able to look, especially a stranger in the eye, and go, I see you and I see you seeing me. So I'm very, very honored, Tanis. Thank you so much. And to be in the new farm art space as well is like, ah, I'm so excited. It's a gorgeous space. Mm-hmm. So lucky Friday the 13th is going to be when
oh,
the show
is. I didn't
the show
even
is,
think of yeah. that.
Perfect yeah. for a clown
yes,
show.
Yes, yes.
And you know, it's funny, Val, I had heard about the show. I think the 89-year-old that was in your audience. He wrote. It was Barry from the Canvas. He
oh,
saw
yes.
the piece at
okay,
the Rivoli,
Barry.
And he wrote to me and said, "Oh my gosh, you have to see this show. This clown is amazing." And I was like, "Okay." And I put that in my my like producer's bank in my little brain. And I was shopping in Calicoon.
Yeah.
I was shopping at the secondhand store in Calicoon at Paula's Pop store or POW store. And there was this woman who went into the dressing room and she was changing. And I was like at the cash register paying for my thing. And I heard the woman in the dressing room say, blah, 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 and I'm a clown. And I was like, you're a clown. And from then on, we've connected.
Wonderful.
Yeah, our first moment was me and my pants were down. And I was like, I'm a clown. I peeked through the curtain. I'm like, yeah, I'm a clown. Hold on. Let me get my pants back on.
It was perfect. And so it's been fun to collaborate since then.
Wonderful. Before I turn to Morgan, did you have specific training?
I studied at NYU. I did the whole Tisch Atlantic Theater Company route because I really wanted to study very seriously theater acting, and Atlantic Theater Company was great. But I really enjoy the physical magic of being on a live performance. So all of my performance teachers there went, have you heard of this school in Paris? So I then, after graduating at NYU Tisch, I went to L'École Internationale du Théâtre Jacques Lecoq in Paris, which for those of you theater people listening, Lecoq is a pretty... pretty renowned school, I do say so myself. So that's where I really figured out how to take the magic of physicality and put it in the direction that I want it to go.
Okay, so this is going to be quite a Friday the 13th. And now let's hear from Morgan, who will be performing on Saturday, September 15th at 7:30. And she will talk about Dora's Gently Used Dream Store. Hi, Morgan.
Hi. Yeah. I'm also so excited to be part of this festival. I'm glad that Ellie touched on that her work comes from partially inspired by the pandemic and the shutdown time. I don't know if it was intentional on Tanis's part, but my work also comes from that time of being alone. Dora's Gently Used Dream Store is a show that I made during the pandemic because I wanted to make a show where the audience was part of the show and that there was a kind of cumulative effect of the audience being there. So Dora's Gently Used Dream Store is a show about a character, Dora, who runs this pop-up shop. And just like a used clothing store or any other used goods store, that she runs the shop where people can donate their gently used dreams or nightmares. So throughout the show, you will see these jars on stage, which are actual dreams and nightmares that I have been collecting over, I forget how many performances I've done now, I think 10 performances of this show. So I have about 30 dreams and nightmares that are on stage with me that are actually the dreams and nightmares donated by past audience members. So the more I perform the show literally grows and changes. There's lots of things in store about dream tropes and other things that can happen while we're asleep.
Well, that sounds very intriguing. I mean, we've all had our nightmares and we've certainly all had our dreams.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's a a phenomenon that we, you know, regardless of the content of our dreams, almost everybody can relate to this idea that a story, you know, a story or images come through us pretty organically as we sleep.
We'll see you on Saturday, and I'm really looking forward to hear about these dreams and nightmares.
Great.
And Tanis, Decompositions is your performance on Sunday.
Yes. So Decompositions will be performed on Sunday, September 15th at 2 p.m., and it'll be the last performance of our festival. And hey, wait a second. I started my play during the pandemic, too. How funny. I didn't realize that. That's really cool. So, you know, alone together we are. So Decompositions is a piece that, as I was saying to Ellie in the car, is definitely the most biographical piece that I have ever made and probably will ever make. Well, you say that now. You never know what you're going to do in however many years. But it's a piece where I perform. My partner is a lovely, gorgeous, huge pile of compost. And I speak about my life and the stages of one's life. And I'm in midlife. I'm a middle-aged woman. And I talk about that, you know, and I talk about incidences, too, in my life where I've faced moments of mortality. I've had a couple of them, and, you know, I've made pieces about it as well, you know, a stroke or breast cancer, you know, having even a child, you know, that was very eventful. And to speak about these things, about, you know, your body and where you are in your living process, is what the play is about. And there's humor and there's movement and there's some interesting texts about that process. And each decomposition is like, you know, it's like chapters of a book. They're not compositions, they're decompositions, and they're titled with a title like decay, phosphorescence, transformation. So it's like a kind of like modeling of the literal decomposing of a sunflower that we talk about in the performances. So yeah, I'm just really excited to share this show. I've been performing it here and there over the last 2 years. It will be the first time in our new space, and I just set the setup this morning, and we're going to put the lights on it tonight, and we're going to tech it tonight, and it just feels so good to be in that room and to have the work and the set and everything in there. And how exciting to also invite such amazing artists as Ellie and Morgan to share this weekend with me. So I
and
hope
the community.
Well, I really hope everyone comes out to see it, because it's going to be some really beautiful performances that are authentic and honest and real, and their work is really exciting to me.
Well, that's this weekend, and it runs Friday through Sunday, and you can go to farmartscollective.org for more information.
Yeah, and people could get a festival pass to see all three shows or individual. And I just want to say, for any listener out there who is like having a moment with finances, some issues, we're always a pay what you can venue. So if you show up and you just can't afford the full price ticket, we just have we have the policy that someone can say, can I do a pay what you can option? And that the answer is always yes at Farm Arts Collective.
Well, thank you so much. And I wish you all a really eventful weekend.
Thank you so much for having us, Val.
Thank you, Val.
Thank you.
That was culture reporter Valerie Manzi speaking to farm arts artists Ellie Jay, Morgan Mackenzie Kaufman, and Tanis Kowalczyk. That'll do it for this edition of Radio Chatskill. A reminder tonight, the Radio Catskill Community Advisory Board will be at Bethel Woods Horizon Happy Hour beginning at 5 to get some feedback on how the station's doing. And there's performances there from Creatures, the Cameramen, and our own Mark Partridge from Ambient Barn, spinning an Ambient Barn DJ set. That's tonight at 5. Free admission. Come out and tell us how we're doing. Enjoy some free jams. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for listening.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from the Narrowsburg Union and Catskills Curated, presenting products of regional artists, artisans, makers, and craftsmen. gift wrapping and shipping available on site. NarrowsburgUnion.com. The Cooperage Project in Honesdale, dedicated to building community through performance, learning, markets, and good times. TheCooperageProject.org. And from listeners like you who donate at WJFFradio.org.
This is Radio Catskill, keeping Pennsylvania voters connected this election season. October 21st is the last day to register before the November general election in Pennsylvania. October 29th is the last day to apply for a mail-in or civilian absentee ballot. And the Pennsylvania County Board of Elections must receive mail-in absentee ballots by 8 p.m. on Election Day. November 5th is Election Day. Pennsylvania polls are open from 7 a.m. to 8 p.m. Radio Catskill, keeping you connected this election season.
WJFF Jeffersonville, streaming live at WJFFradio.org. This is Radio Catskill, local news, culture, and NPR. Today's weather, sunny, 75 for a high, clear 50s tonight's low, and the warm, sunny weather continues from tomorrow through the weekend. Sunny, 78 Thursday, 81 Friday, high of 80 Saturday, 77 Sunday. It's 11 o'clock.